Our platform this morning is titled Ulysses Grant, An Unlikely Success Story. Ulysses S. Grant was the most successful Union general during the Civil War and eventually commanded all the Union armies. He later became a two-term president. He did not have an impressive appearance. He was short, slight, and always looked rumpled. He was soft-spoken, not a self-promoter. He was never an outstanding student. How did this seemingly ordinary man achieve so much? This will be presented this morning by Andy Stanton. Andy and his wife Mary Ellen have lived in St. Charles for the past year and a half and have become members of the Ethical Society for that long. The Stantons moved here from Washington, D.C. area, where they lived for many years and worked and raised their daughter. Andy and Mary Ellen are longtime members of the Northern Virginia Ethical Society, and I still believe they still are. Andy was a lawyer with the U.S. Department of Agriculture for approximately 34 years and retired in 2008. So please help me welcome Andy Stanton. When I tell you to, throw that in there, okay?
Okay.
Which one, the one on the right or the one on the left?
One on the right.
I did the one on the right. Is that the right one?
Yes, sir.
All right. I got it. Well, good morning, everyone. As Bill said, Ulysses S. Grant seemed to be an unlikely person to achieve the things he did. And that's one of the things that really attracted me to him. Because I really didn't know much about him. I knew he was a general, and I knew he was a successful general, and he was president. But in looking at him, I always wondered, he doesn't look like someone who would be so successful. I mean, most generals look very distinguished, and he was kind of sloppily dressed, rumpled. Even as president, he was very modest, and especially when you compare it to what we have today. I mean, how could someone like that be president? So I did some research, and one thing I did, of course, is I looked at the internet. Everybody does that. But for more depth of understanding, I felt I needed to read further. So I found a very excellent book called American Ulysses, A Life of Ulysses S. Grant by an author, Ronald C. White. This is a 2016 volume. This is an excellent book. It gives a highly detailed and well-researched account of Grant's life. It received great reviews and won numerous awards. I then read another book, a book called Grant by Ron Chernow, and that was published in 2017. And if you've heard of Ron Chernow, he wrote Hamilton, which was the basis for the play. And Chernow's book won a Pulitzer Prize. And this covers the same type of ground as Grant. It's very detailed, talks about his personal life and his highs and lows. They also talked about Grant's memoirs. And that's a big part of Grant's life. He wrote toward the end of his life. And it's supposed to be very, very well written. And not like most of the works done at the time. This is done in the early 1880s. So I know from my experience with ethical culture that the founder of ethical culture, Felix Adler, wrote books around that time that are very flowery and very hard to read. But Grant's memoirs are supposed to be very straightforward. So in fact, so I decided to buy it. And in fact, it is. And I'll just read you an excerpt from it so you can see that It's certainly very straightforward. And here he is talking about his experience when he was before he became a general, and when he was at camp called Camp Salubrity. At Camp Salubrity, and we went to the New Orleans barracks, the 4th Infantry was commanded by Colonel Vos, then an old gentleman who had not commanded on drill for a number of years. He was not a man to discover infirmity in the presence of danger. It now appeared that war was imminent, and he felt that it was his duty to brush up his tactics. Accordingly, when we got settled down at our new post, he took command of the regiment at a battalion drill. Only two or three evolutions had been gone through when he dismissed the battalion and, turning to go to his own quarters, dropped dead. He had not been complaining of ill health, but no doubt died of heart disease. He was the most estimable man of exemplary habits and by no means the author of his own disease. I thought it was kind of, I guess Grant was kind of trying to be a little bit amusing in a kind of wry sort of fashion. But that, you know, it's straightforward writing. Nothing flowery about it. Not like Felix Adler's writing, that's for sure. So I also heard about this video. A lot of the writers were talking about that was made on PBS. It was made and shown on PBS in the early 2000s. It was called Ulysses S. Grant, Warrior President. So I decided to buy that. And, well, it's a great video. It's not only talks about his life, but they have a lot of experts, historians, who comment through the video, and they have reproductions of various battle scenes and a very good, excellent. They show old photographs and posters. It's a terrific video, and I included a couple of excerpts from it in this talk. So, Ulysses S. Grant was born in Point Pleasant, Ohio, on April 27, 1822. He was the firstborn of Jesse and Hannah Grant. His father, Jesse, a highly opinionated man, was a prosperous businessman, a tanner. Jesse expected Ulysses to become a tanner as well, but Ulysses hated the blood and guts of the tanning industry. In fact, during his life, he'd only eat his meat extremely well done, which is kind of interesting considering his eventual career. Ulysses loved horses and was an excellent rider, which served him well during his military career. And in fact, he always wanted to be around horses, and he thought that he would eventually have something in kind of profession to do with horses, but he kind of did in a way. But anyway, he was an excellent rider. He did not do that well in school because he did not apply himself, except in math, for which he had a natural aptitude. Now, unknown to Ulysses, his father decided that he was going to go to West Point. And one of the reasons is that he heard that West Point would give him a wonderful education and be cost-free. So Jesse wanted that for Ulysses. So he told Ulysses that, and Ulysses didn't want to go, but Jesse said, "You're going." And Ulysses was only 16 years old. He was younger and smaller than all of his classmates. And in the course of applying, the authorities mistakenly noted his name as Ulysses Simpson Grant. Rather than going through the trouble of correcting the mistake, because, as I said, his given name was Hiram Ulysses Grant. But rather than going through the trouble of correcting it, he just accepted his new name. And that's kind of the way Ulysses was. I mean, he just didn't want to make a big deal out of things. He was not a dedicated student. He read a lot of novels when he was supposed to be studying. But he still managed to graduate in the middle of his class because he was, as I said, he was very good in math and horsemanship. And he was also an excellent artist. So here's a portion of the PBS video that'll give you more insight into Grant's early life.
Thank you.
Oh, yeah.
It's an unknown play bar.
Sorry.
It's that one down there.
Oh, okay. It's not working.
Heard, 1863, Chattanooga, Tennessee.
No, this is not right. Sorry. This is not right. This is not working. All right, here we go.
Little distinguished Ulysses S. Grant as a youth, except that he had a way with horses.
Grant loved horses. He was remarkable with horses. He could always calm the most fractious horse.
Grant communed. He communicated with that horse just naturally. It just flowed between him and the horse.
To be a good person with horses, one has to be calm and firm and quiet. And he was all three of those things.
My family is American and has been for generations in all its branches. Direct and collateral, he would write. Ulysses S. Grant grew up in the Ohio River Valley. His father, Jesse Root Grant, had arrived in Georgetown, Ohio in 1823, when Grant was 1 year old. He was the descendant of pioneers who had settled the western frontier.
For them, the American dream was a real thing. They had come into open, clear, virgin territory. They had cleaned the forest out. They had built up farms. They had made the land. This was the valley of democracy, where democracy seemed to be working itself out in the lives of homesteaders.
It was also a place where a great national drama was being played out.
He grew up really on the border between slaveholding Kentucky and free Ohio. His hometown was filled with Southern transplants, and the ideas for and against slavery were much in the air. His father had an opinion on that, as he did on everything.
An ardent abolitionist, Jesse Grant was outspoken on the issue of slavery, voicing his opinion in local newspapers for all to read. His wife, Hannah, had no such desire for recognition.
She was notorious for her silence. She was always on guard against pride, and being quiet was one way not to catch yourself being proud. When Grant accomplished something, she said nothing, and she showed very little affection. So she was a difficult person to be around, a very withholding person.
Grant's personality, his calm demeanor, reflected traits inherited from his mother. There is a driving ambition in him that is reminiscent of his father, but certainly not the boastfulness that went along with it.
A man with a talent for making money, Jesse Grant had chosen one of the most lucrative, yet unpleasant professions of his time.
A tannery, particularly a 19th century tannery, was a place of blood everywhere, gobs of animal fat, smells, extraordinary smells that were said to stick with the tanner. You could tell a tanner no matter how many times he had washed and bathed because the whole business stuck to him. Something in Grant's soul just recoiled from that.
50 years later, Grant could still recall the stench of his father's tannery drifting into his childhood bedroom. "I detested the trade," he wrote. "I attended the village schools," Grant said of his childhood. "I was not studious in habit, but never missed a quarter." His real passion was horses. When he was 12, he fell in love with a colt owned by a neighbor, Mr. Ralston.
Grant admired the colt, wanted to buy it badly. Went to his father for business advice on how to negotiate. Said he wanted to pay $25 for the horse. So old Jesse, shrewd trader that he was, said, "Well, Ulysses, offer 20. If Ralston won't take that, offer 22 and a half. And if Ralston won't take that, then offer the 25. And so Ulysses trots off to Mr. Ralston, looks at him, says, "I want to buy this horse. And Papa says to offer you 20. If you won't take that, I'll offer 22 and a half. And if you won't take that, offer 25. And of course, Ralston sells the horse for $25.
Worried his son showed little direction, Jesse chose a career for him. Christmas 1838. When Ulysses was 16, he learned that his father had gotten him an appointment to the United States Military Academy at West Point.
Jesse Grant was the kind of man who would follow a dollar to hell. And when he learned about the possibility of sending his son to West Point at government expense, he jumped at the opportunity. It was only when the appointment was a sure thing that he finally told Ulysses that he's going to West Point. Young Grant said, "I won't go." And Jesse said, "You will."
When Ulysses Grant arrived at West Point, he stood 5 feet 1 inch and weighed just 117 pounds. "I had a very exalted idea of the requirements necessary to get through," he wrote. "I did not believe I possessed them and could not bear the idea of failing." Grant was out of place in the West Point cadets' world of military drills, crossed belts, and gleaming brass.
He didn't have the military bearing. When Grant was a student at West Point, they were still talking about the famous cadet who had gone through 10 years earlier without a single demerit, a record I think that still stands, and that was Robert Lee. And Grant was the very opposite of that. He slouched, he cut classes, he stayed in his room.
Cadet Grant was required to learn drawing in order to sketch battlefields and plan campaigns. But it was his renderings of landscapes and his paintings which most impressed his professors, along with his command of mathematics.
It was his natural aptitude for mathematics that carried him through to graduation. Other classes he took far less seriously, did the minimum amount of work, and under the circumstances, graduated respectably.
Grant placed 21st in a class of 39. Years later, one classmate remarked, "No one could possibly be more surprised than myself at Grant's amazing success."
Okay. Crap.
October 23rd.
Some reason it's... I don't know how to get back. Yeah, that's right. Okay. Now, while he was at West Point, Ulysses met Julia Dent, the sister of one of his fellow cadets, and the two hit it off. Now, Julia was the daughter of a St. Louis plantation owner, whose owner, whose Whitehaven estate is now an historic site. If you've ever been down there, you can see it. And I was down there years ago, but I intend to go back. Julius' family owned numerous slaves, which created a problem for Ulysses, considering, as we found out, his father was a strict abolitionist. After graduation, Ulysses was assigned to Jefferson Barracks, which is also in southern St. Louis, down by the Mississippi River. While he was there, he saw a lot of Julia, and they became engaged and then married. In 1846, the Mexican War began, and Grant saw service for 2 years until Mexico was defeated. And while he was in Mexico, Grant met many officers with whom he later served and fought against. When Grant returned from Mexico, he wanted to spend his time with Julia and start a family. And eventually, he and Julia did have 4 children. However, his domestic life was constantly interrupted by the army reassigning him to various locations. And eventually, Grant ended up in California, where he was extremely unhappy and apparently developed a drinking problem. And I don't know if you heard, oh, Grant was a drunk. Well, he did have a problem, but it was blown up to be more than it was. While in California, Grant tried various business ventures to supplement his military salary, but unfortunately they all failed. He was heavily criticized by his commanders for his drinking, and he resigned from the military, returning home to his family. His father-in-law let Ulysses and the family live at Whitehaven, and Grant built a farm, which is still located on the estate. You can see Grant's farm if you visit Whitehaven. But no matter how hard Grant worked, he could not merely make a go of it as a farmer. He tried other business ventures without success. Eventually, he and the family moved to Illinois, where he became a clerk at a hardware store run by his younger brother, which was kind of humiliating. It was a very difficult period for Ulysses, as this portion of the video demonstrates.
In 1854, Grant was transferred to Fort Humboldt, a remote post on the Northern California coast. It was at Humboldt that Ulysses S. Grant acquired a reputation that would haunt him for the rest of his life.
He was intensely lonely, and he ran into a very autocratic martinet of an officer that made him miserable. Depression was very serious. He was not riding his horse. He was staying in the barracks. And he was really in very bad shape.
To add to his despair, he had not heard from Julia all winter.
One night, he had a dream about encountering Julia, dancing away the night with other officers, ignoring him as if he didn't exist. And this only played upon his feelings of insecurity that perhaps Juliet had second thoughts, that perhaps there was a better life for her elsewhere.
My dear wife, you do not know how forsaken I feel here. The state of suspense that I am in is scarcely bearable. I sometimes get so anxious to see you and our little boys that I am almost tempted to resign and trust to Providence and my own exertions for a living. Whenever I get thinking about the subject, poverty begins to stare me in the face. Grant sought solace in whiskey. Fellow officers noticed his slurred speech after the first glass. Liquor seemed a virulent poison to him, and yet he had a fierce desire for it, one officer recalled. One glass would show on him, and 2 or 3 would make him stupid.
He got drunk for 2 reasons. One, because he missed his wife tremendously and felt very lonely. when she wasn't around. And secondly, if Grant had two drinks, he got drunk. It's not that he drank a lot. Grant could get drunk on very little. And people noticed it.
On April 11th, 1854, yearning to return to his family, Captain Ulysses Grant resigned from the United States Army. It was rumored that whiskey had cost him his commission. Jesse Grant was not pleased by his son's sudden resignation and tried unsuccessfully to get the Army not to accept it. I think after spending so much time to qualify for the Army and spending so many years in the service, he will be poorly qualified for the pursuits of private life, he wrote Secretary of War Jefferson Davis. Grant was 32 when he returned to Missouri, ready, as he said, to commence a new struggle for our support. He accepted an offer from Julia's father to farm land at Whitehaven. Grant built their first home with his own hands and called it Hardscrabble. He was proud of it, but Julia found it homely and crude, a far cry from the comforts of Whitehaven. Wandering the empty rooms, she asked herself, is this my destiny?
Everything that happened to Grant for the next 3 or 4 years is in that name that he gave, Hardscrabble. He meant it, I think, as a kind of dig at his father-in-law's pretentious name for his farm, Whitehaven. So hard scrabble. But it pretty much summed up what he went through.
With the help of the Dent family slaves and one slave of his own, Grant set to work clearing the land to plant oats, corn, and potatoes. But just as he failed as a businessman, he also failed as a farmer. He eventually had to abandon hardscrabble. Grant moved to St. Louis, where he could have sold his slave, William Jones, for $1,000, but instead, he freed him. He took a job as a bill collector, then a custom house clerk. One Christmas, he had to pawn his watch to buy his wife and children presents.
He had lost everything. He had no job. He had no prospects. And so he turned to his father, hat in hand.
Ulysses asked for a loan. When you are ready to come north, I will give you a start, Jesse replied. But so long as you make your home among a tribe of slaveholders, I will do nothing. Ulysses S. Grant arrived in Galena, Illinois in the spring of 1860 to begin a new life working at his father's harness and leather shop. Grant worked as a clerk, hoping someday to be made a partner like his younger brother Orville. But for now, he mostly totaled up the bills.
Under his father's thumb and his brother Orville's thumb, too, I don't think Grant was very happy at all in those early Galena days. But he was desperate. He had to take care of his family.
After work, Grant would climb the steep stairs behind the leather shop leading to his house high up on the hill.
Grant would come home and open the door, and more often than not, in the family legends, his son would pounce on him and say, "Mister, do you want to fight?" And Grant would answer, "I'm a man of peace, but I will not be hectored by a person of your size." And they would tumble and wrestle and roll all over the floor until Grant would finally say, "Enough," and surrender to his little boy.
In the evenings, he would read the news out loud to Julia. 1860 was an election year, and the papers were filled with reports of the growing national crisis over slavery and secession. I deplored the agitation of abolitionists, he later said, but talk of dissolution of the Union made my blood run cold.
He was a reasonable man in an unreasonable time. This man had seen war. And unlike a lot of people who were agitating, he knew what secession would mean. He was not eager for that.
Okay, well, not long after that, the Civil War did break out. And Grant volunteered. And due to his West Point background, he was appointed to command the enlisted men of Galena, his town. He demonstrated a great deal of aptitude on the battlefield, and he was promoted to Brigadier General. And some of his earlier notable battles were at Belmont in southern Missouri and at Forts Henry and Donelson in Kentucky, all of which he won. In April 1862, his army was camped on the Tennessee River near the Shiloh Church when it was subjected to a surprise attack by the Confederates. The battle was very bloody, and Grant's forces were almost driven into the river. Fortunately for Grant, he received reinforcements overnight and drove the Confederates from the field the next day. However, Grant was very heavily criticized by his superior, General Halleck, and he was demoted. So here is another portion of the video that deals with this very important event in Grant's life. I'd like to go to visit it myself.
On April 6th, 1862, Grant's army was camped on the Tennessee River near a church called Shiloh. At his headquarters, 9 miles away, Grant made plans to deliver what he thought would be the decisive blow against the Confederacy. The Confederates were planning an offensive of their own. At dawn, rebels in the tens of thousands burst out of the woods at Shiloh, surprising Grant's troops and overrunning their camps. Grant arrived at the front at 8 that morning to find his army on the verge of collapse.
He finds the rear area in complete disarray. Hundreds, if not thousands, of men cowering under the bluffs. A situation that suggests that a complete disaster has occurred.
He's going from commander to commander, moving up reinforcements, arranging for supplies, rallying men, giving up ground inch by inch in a stubborn effort to hold on.
At one point, he came under fire. One bullet barely missed him. Another grazed his horse. A third struck his sword scabbard. Through it all, Grant remained unperturbed.
He knows reinforcements are on the way. He believes the Confederates cannot maintain the sort of attack that they've initiated early that morning. He knows that if his men can stand their ground until dusk, that he will prevail eventually at Shiloh.
A general who can ride around the battlefield, and by glimpsing, men advancing over there, troops forming up over here, artillery firing somewhere in the distance, and can put all of these pieces together in his head and see what is actually happening through the smoke, that is a general who has an extraordinary gift.
That evening, the flash of Union gunboats shelling Confederate positions revealed the aftermath of battle. The Union Army had taken a terrible beating. Kept awake by the blast of cannons, Grant sought refuge under an oak tree. then in a log house which had been turned into a field hospital. The sight was more unendurable than encountering the enemy's fire, he later wrote, and I returned to my tree. Grant's most aggressive general, William Tecumseh Sherman, who commanded a division at Shiloh, approached.
Sherman's been under fire all day, and by the end of April 6th, he's convinced that the time has come to retreat from the field. But as he sees Grant, something in him says, don't give that kind of advice. He walks up to his friend, looks him in the eye, and says, well, Grant, we've had the devil's own day, haven't we? Grant takes a puff of his cigar, looks up, and says, yep. Lick him tomorrow, though.
The next day, Grant's battered army, reinforced overnight, recaptured the bloody ground lost the day before, but at a price Grant could not have imagined. I saw an open field in our possession, so covered with dead that it would have been possible to walk across the clearing in any direction, stepping on dead bodies without a foot touching the ground. As casualty lists began to appear in newspapers, the public was horrified. The 2 days of fighting had left more dead than all the battles previously fought on American soil. 24,000 casualties in all. It took a mile of trenches to bury the dead.
Shiloh does provide a turning point. In Grant's own mind, it convinces him that the Confederacy is not the hollow shell about to collapse that he had thought after his relatively easy victories at Fort Henry and Fort Donelson. I think it also shocks a lot of the Northern people into an awareness that if they are going to win this war, it's going to be a victory that comes at very high cost.
Nobody had expected a bloodletting like that. Certainly Northern public opinion hadn't anticipated it. There was no preparation for that kind of carnage. Someone had to be blamed for such an enormous loss of life, and the person they blamed was Grant.
Such amazing blundering and gross negligence was probably never before heard of in the history of war, one newspaper declared. Here is a case that calls loudly, peremptorily, for a court-martial. 6 weeks earlier, he had been unconditional surrender Grant, the victorious hero of Donelson. Now he was Butcher Grant, the incompetent commander of Shiloh. It was even rumored he had been drunk the night before the battle. In Covington, Kentucky, where she was staying with Hannah and Jesse Grant, Julia read the news. I sat shocked and almost stunned at articles and abuse of my husband just after the Battle of Shiloh. I felt too deeply wounded to weep. I felt hard and revengeful. Shiloh not only damaged Grant's reputation, it cost him his command. Although Grant had averted disaster at Shiloh, all General Halleck could think of was the carnage of the first day.
General Halleck became convinced that Grant really couldn't manage a large army and that he had been surprised, and so Halleck came personally to Pittsburgh Landing to take control and basically put Grant on the shelf by naming him to the meaningless post of second in command.
That pattern of his early adulthood that he thought was broken, he's a general now, thought that's all over, the pattern of continual failing, of downward spiraling, and now he's gone up high to command and only to go down again.
Confined to his headquarters, without an army of his own, Grant wrote in despair, "My position differs but little from one in arrest. I owe it to myself to ask either full restoration to duty or to be relieved entirely."
There's a lot more on the video, but I don't have time to really show it, but I do want to get back to the Grant story. Incidentally, this is a wonderful video, and I'll be happy to lend it to anyone who wants to look at it. Now, after General Halleck had the army, he failed to aggressively pursue the Confederate army as Grant would have. So President Lincoln reinstated Grant. Grant knew that control of the Mississippi River depended on reducing the Confederate stronghold at Vicksburg, Mississippi. And for several months, he conducted a creative and brilliant campaign against the army, which eventually led to Vicksburg's surrender on July 4, 1863, which incidentally was the same day as the Battle of Gettysburg was won on the other side of the U.S., in Pennsylvania. So after Grant's victory at Vicksburg, Lincoln promoted him to Major General to command all the armies in Mississippi and Tennessee. Grant decisively won an important battle in Chattanooga, Tennessee, in which he again showed his excellence as a commander. And afterwards, Lincoln appointed him to command all the Union armies as Lieutenant General, the first person of that rank since George Washington. Grant moved east and took command of the Army of the Potomac, which had a history of failure against Confederate General Robert E. Lee. Grant decided that the best strategy was to keep moving south and aggressively wear down Lee's army. And after many bloody battles in the area between Richmond and Fredericksburg, including such famous battles as the Wilderness, Spotsylvania Courthouse, and Cold Harbor, Grant's army decisively defeated Lee and forced him to surrender at Appomattox Courthouse, which is south of Richmond, in April 1865. So why was Grant such an excellent general? And as you could hear from some of the historians on the video, he had a very calm demeanor. He was modest but not hesitant to exert his authority. He was able to remain calm and unflustered even when facing extremely stressful battlefield situations. He had excellent strategic vision. He correctly realized that his objective was to destroy the Confederate strong points and armies, and he was focused on those goals. He made sure his soldiers were adequately supplied and trained. He had an excellent memory and was able to get the overall picture of the battlefield based on the disparate bits of information being reported. And perhaps most importantly, he was an excellent communicator. He delivered his orders in writing in clear, understandable style so that his subordinates knew exactly what they had to do. So Grant continued as chief of all the federal armies until 1868, when, as the most popular person in the U.S., he decided to run for president, and he won by a large margin. He was 46, the youngest president up to that time, and he was reelected in 1872. So Grant's presidency had many significant accomplishments. He signed legislation establishing an 8-hour workday for federal employees. He established regulations for a new board of Indian commissioners in an effort to curb abuses by Indian agents. He established a division of telegrams and reports for the benefit of commerce, which was called at the time, which became later the National Weather Service, and established Yellowstone as the nation's first national park. However, his major accomplishment was in the area of civil rights. He decided, unlike the previous president, Andrew Johnson, he decided that he needed to defend the former slaves from the depredations of the angry white Southerners who refused to accept the result of the Civil War. And he actually sent troops to the South, and he broke up the Ku Klux Klan. And that Ku Klux Klan was actually disbanded and dead for probably a generation, but unfortunately it did come back. So Grant's tenure as president was, and you might have heard this, was unfortunately marked by a series of scandals in which members of his administration engaged in illegal financial schemes. Sound familiar? While Grant did not personally benefit from these schemes, they did reflect a failing of his. He was just too trusting. He was such a good judge of character during the war, appointing the proper generals for the tasks to be performed, but his judgment of people failed as president. His failure to properly judge the character of his associates continued after he left office in 1876 and moved to New York City. And as a result, he became practically destitute in the 1880s. In 1884, he was diagnosed with throat cancer, and knowing that he would soon die, he decided to write his memoirs so he could leave his wife, Julia, with enough income to live on. He completed his memoirs shortly before his death in July 1885, and in fact, they did make a lot of money for his wife. And he's buried in a tomb in New York City. So There's a lot more to Grant's life, and as I said, if anybody wants to borrow this DVD, that would be fine with me. I still admire him very much. He had his negatives, that definitely, but he was a good person. He was a very talented person, and he's an indication to all of us that you don't have to be the best at everything to be a success. And I found him to be a very inspiring figure. So, thank you.